Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 6th of June. We are going to talk about the cost of health care in America this hour of the program. And I was delighted to see the really important article written by one of our guests in Sunday's New York Times last Sunday. It's part of a Pain Till It Hurts healthcare series that the Times will be running, and we are going to post the first article on our Facebook page in case you didn't have a chance to read it. It's a very provocative and informative article. Elizabeth Rosenthal is a journalist for the Times covering health and environment, and she wrote this piece in which she says it's very lengthy, but she writes about colonoscopies because she says they offer a compelling case study. But she says Americans pay four times as much for hip replacement as patients in Switzerland or France, three times as much for C-sections as those in New Zealand. The average price for Nasonex, those of you who are suffering from allergy season may be using this. It's a common nasal spray for allergies. $108 in the U.S., $21 in Spain. The cost of hospital stays here about triple those in other developed nations. And she is one of our guests this hour to talk about why this is. And also to look at why we're not examining this very carefully in this country. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us. What a terrific article that was. It was just very, very good. Oh, wait a second. You can't hear me because now I had the wrong thing here. Elizabeth, thank you for being with us. It was a wonderful article. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Also joining us is Professor Tom Oliver. Professor Oliver is director of the UW-Madison Master of Public Health Program and is a professor, Department of Population Health Sciences. This is an affiliate with the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs. He examines critical issues in health policy, politics, and system reform. Professor Oliver, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with you, Elizabeth. You know, you read this article and you realize that we have just not had much of a national conversation about health care costs in this country. And I must ask you why, because you read your article and you say somebody needs to sit down and talk about this.
Well, I think it's partly because when you open your bills or you open your explanation of benefits, you're sitting in your living room and you look at this bill and you say, as I did, 5 years ago when I had my first colonoscopy, wow, $9,000, what's
Whoa.
That about? Right, I had a real high number there. And you think, well, that's insane. And I actually went the next step of calling my health insurer, saying, could this be right? As the woman in the series did, I called the hospital and said, this seems unreasonable. But in the end, life goes on. You have other things to do. And I have pretty good insurance, so I wasn't paying it. So I think it's an invisible cost to most voters and most consumers in the sense of, we don't pay it, so there's very little incentive for anyone in the system to keep costs down, except when you look in the larger view where our insurance premiums are going up, our copays and deductibles are going up, our deficit is, you know, starting to get lower, but healthcare costs are a significant part of our deficit. Mm. So the consequences are huge, but not very immediate.
$9,000, and when you look at what people pay routinely in other countries, there is probably no other country on earth where it costs more than $1,000.
No, I think, looking internationally, and that was part of my personal perspective, I'd lived overseas for about a decade for the New York Times. So I was pretty attuned to what healthcare costs are other places. So, it was really eye-popping to me, 9,000. Many countries, it's under 500. So those numbers are really high, and it was what impelled me to try and figure out, well, why? Why are these bills so high for us?
Without being too crass here, is it fair to say that part of the reason is that there's money to be made in colonoscopies for a number of people?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. You know, we have what we like to consider, as one someone in the article said, a market-driven system, but it's a very flawed market. And there are so many different people who are taking their share of the profit off of each and every medical procedure that it really, really adds up.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you the same question, Professor Oliver. Why in the world have we not had a really extensive conversation about why healthcare costs so much? We already had one about how we want to reform the system. Aren't we missing an obvious question?
I think the answer is that we haven't had everybody in the system to the point where we realize that the costs of taking care of others are coming back to us as well. I think Elizabeth made the point that is analogous to the old-fashioned idea of adding your cow to graze at the commons in the old-fashioned New England town. You know, what's the difference if I eat, if my cow gets the grass, what difference will it make? But if everybody has that mentality, pretty soon there's no grass left. You've consumed all these resources. And so the prices for everybody add up, and we're paying it in the U.S. in the form of what we have to pay towards our private health insurance, if we're lucky enough to have it, and what our employers pay. We're paying it in taxes towards the Medicare program and the Medicaid program, and we're paying for the uninsured who can't afford these kinds of prices that are charged to them. So it comes back to haunt us in a number of ways, but as Elizabeth said, it's kind of invisible at the point at which we're having to make those decisions with our doctors.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of her article, Professor Oliver?
I think it is a great two-punch in the 1-2 punch that was contributed by Stephen Brill's article in the first week of March in Time magazine,
yes,
which was a cover story. And I think Elizabeth's article is going to start a conversation here along with Stephen Brill's, because now enough people are aware of these both outrageous prices, number one, and also outrageous variations in prices, which is also really important, to begin asking questions of both their doctors and their insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the conversation needs to go to.
Elizabeth, let's spend a little more time on the colonoscopies, as you do in your article. You could do one of these procedures, and they have been done in the doctor's offices. Now we have all these special surgical centers. How does that add to the cost, and why did we move in that direction?
Well, the reason it adds to cost is when you have it done in a procedure suite in a doctor's office, you just get one bill from the doctor. But most insurers, including Medicare, if it's done in a surgery center, an ambulatory surgery center, or in a hospital, add on what's called a facility fee. Now, I have to say, when I called European hospitals and physicians to ask about colonoscopy and said, well, what's your facility fee? I drew a blank. They were like, what do you mean a facility fee? You can't do a colonoscopy unless you're in a room with stuff. So that's one aspect. There's a facility fee added on. Then also, when you get into a more surgical setting, there's the tendency to add an anesthesiologist, which is another big controversy about colonoscopies. Colonoscopies require something called moderate sedation. It's kind of like what you have maybe when you have a wisdom tooth taken out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not full anesthesia. But when an anesthesiologist is in the room to administer that, then there's an anesthesiologist's bill as well. So there are all these added costs that come in when you move the setting.
So what did you get? Gourmet food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner for $9,000?
Well, I thought I was being smart when I did this, actually. My own story is kind of, I think it reveals a lot about the flaws in the system. I came back after 10 years overseas for the New York Times, first in Asia and then in Europe. And I turned 50. I needed a colonoscopy. So I went to a private doctor and my internist, who referred me to a private gastroenterologist, who who said, oh, you know, this is going to be your out-of-pocket cost. And it was high. So I called my insurer and said, well, who's in network? I want to have this done in network because I don't want to pay this $500 out of pocket cost. So they said, oh, if you go to any of the hospitals in network, it will be in network, and then you won't have to pay, or you'll just pay a small copay. So I without naming names, because all of the hospitals do this, I went to a hospital, signed up, said, do you have a colonoscopy screening clinic? They said, sure. I signed up, I went in, and I thought, well, this is a little funny. It's like I'm checking in for surgery, but I didn't think very much of it. Was wheeled into an OR, there were nurses, you know, gastroenterologists, had the procedure, it was a dream, you know, recovery room. But then when to me it was cheap. But then I looked at the explanation of benefits and saw the charges, and I was like, whoa, it's cheap mm-hmm. to me, but not really cheap to me.
Mm-hmm. When does, maybe we need a little bit better understanding, Professor Oliver, of the Medicare and Medicaid system. How do they negotiate? How do they set payment rates for services? And does anybody other than Medicaid or Medicare do that in this country?
Well, a lot of insurance programs, private and public, set what they're willing to pay, and that's part of the problem. But only Medicare really has a strong cost basis for its price setting. And so I think one of the important questions here is, what's the price being charged versus what is the actual cost of delivering, whether it's a colonoscopy or a hip replacement or a transplant or any other costly procedure? And it's pretty clear that the variation in the prices charged illustrate that we're not seeing a whole lot of pressure and good shopping on the part of insurance programs to bring the charge down close to what the actual costs are. But Medicare does by far the best job of doing that, and they're under pressure to both reflect costs as closely as they can so that physicians and hospitals and other participants doing the clinical care will continue to see Medicare patients, but they're also protecting taxpayers because of the right. Enormous amount of public revenues that go into paying for the care. And so they have to do the best dance between what is appropriate and what is reasonable.
Yeah. Elizabeth, I'm missing something here, because it seems as though it's in everybody's interest. Employers are paying more. Employees are paying more. It's in everybody's interest, and where is the pressure to make sure that insurance companies are looking at the cost of things? I don't get this. I don't know why they're not naturally doing that as part of their job.
Well, I think part of the problem is that they have only kind of moderate incentive to do so. If costs go up, for the most part, they can pass them on through higher premiums, higher deductibles, higher copays, making the patient pay more. So I think they don't have very strong incentive to do that either. I think one of the more interesting experiments I learned about was when Safeway in California, noticing that they were paying hugely varied prices for colonoscopies for their employees, set a price and said, this is what we'll pay. And it was more towards the low end than the high end. But, you know, one of the things I think we should all remember, or two of the things, is that, yes, colon cancer screening is important, so you should get it, but not necessarily with colonoscopy. That's the second issue. But the other one is that over and over again, when people have looked, there's no direct correlation between cost and quality. So my $9,000 colonoscopy is probably no better than I think Safeway set the price at $1,250, which they thought was a reasonable price, a $1,250 colonoscopy. And we're not getting value.
And they had a lot of takers, right? It wasn't as though nobody stepped up to the plate and said, people did say, we can do this for that.
Yes, and Medicare has a lot of takers, even though they pay lower rates than any of the commercial insurers for colonoscopies, probably.
Hmm. And what about Medicare? Let's talk about that for just a moment. We hear from doctors. I know I did when my dad was going through a lot of procedures. Some doctors saying, you know, we can't take Medicare. They just don't pay us enough money. What's that all about, Professor Oliver?
Well, that's a claim, again, about the amount of payments that are received from Medicare compared to the costs of providing the care and compared to the charges, which are basically a wish on the part of the doctors. And, you know, the story that I hear is that the charges, that is the list price that's being put out there, is generally the charge that the, you know, the most willing insurance company is willing to pay. And it's not something that's expected by the physicians or the hospitals. But if somebody is dumb enough to pay that, or the way they operate, they pay some percentage of the list price, that becomes then the thing that everybody gets in their bill. And so when Elizabeth received her explanation of benefits, that, you know, list price, so to speak, is not necessarily what was actually paid by her insurance company. And so, you know, this debate, I guess, you know, what I am trying to get to when I, you know, talk with students and talk with my colleagues about this is, what's the actual cost here? And let's be talking about costs, not you know, list prices right. that you realize are basically made up and pretty fictional. The one thing that I would say is Medicare, we can expect to pay the most appropriate payment based on cost, but because it's a fee-for-service payment, they don't do very well in controlling whether the procedure should be provided in the first place. So we can trust Medicare to pay pretty well of what is appropriate to pay for the procedure, but they don't do a good job of giving incentives to decide whether you should get the colonoscopy right. versus a blood test versus nothing at all in the first place. And that's where the Affordable Care Act, or health care reform, or Obamacare, however you want to call it, actually has some promise by creating these accountable care organizations in which if you give somebody a $9,000 colonoscopy and you pay your doctors for doing that, then the accountable care organization is going to have to you know, find other sources of savings if they overpay for a colonoscopy or a hip replacement or knee replacement or a bypass surgery or anything else.
Oh, that's interesting. And you write about that, that there are Medicare patients in your study for the article who are given colonoscopies who really don't even need them, right, Elizabeth?
Yes. There's a doctor at the University of Texas in the health system in Galveston who's done some studies on this, and he's a geriatrician. He's quite upset because the official U.S. Preventive Task Force guidelines say 50 to 75 routine colonoscopy for cancer screening once every 10 years. That's one of the options, not the only one. But he's seeing a lot of patients who are getting them over 75 into their 80s. And his point is, for those of you who haven't had a colonoscopy, you know, it requires a night of a clean out. You get sedation of some sort. And in an elderly patient who may be debilitated by other illnesses, there are real risks in this procedure. And so it is actually dangerous to overuse it in the elderly population.
We're going to go to phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we are posting Elizabeth's article appearing last Sunday in the New York Times, Pain Till It Hurts. It's part of a series, case study in high costs. She covers health and the environment for the New York Times and lived, as you heard her say, in Asia and in Europe, working for the Times for 10 years. The article has an interesting international perspective on the high costs here. Also joining us is Professor Tom Oliver. He's a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences, director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Master of Public Health Program. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of our guests this hour, Elizabeth Rosenthal, writes in last Sunday's New York Times in an article, Pain Till It Hurts, we pay more for almost every interaction with the medical system, prescribe more expensive procedures and tests than people in other countries, no matter if they are private or national health systems. Let's go to phone calls. Ken in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I own a company that sells into the healthcare industry. I have experience with both public and private. And if everybody knew what I know, they would just, oh, what the heck is going on?
What do you know, Ken?
Well, more than what I can talk about in a couple minutes. But let's put it this way. Many of your larger medical facilities act as if they have a bottomless pit of money. As far as they're concerned, they do, because it touches on what you talked about earlier, that if they have to pay for something more for something that they really want, they know that all they need to do is raise their costs. So a lot of the problem goes to for one thing, there isn't competition anymore. There's been so much consolidation that when you have two or three major medical facilities in a community the size of, let's say, Madison, that's not competition anymore. When you have five or six, competition has an effect. I was told right to my face that money was no issue, that they will buy what they want, the brand that they want. I mean, when they're shopping for the same piece of equipment, the same brand, then they kind of look at cost and availability of service and that sort of thing. But if mm-hmm. they're looking at a specific brand that they want, and you're selling a different brand but at a third the cost, mm-hmm. they won't even look at it, even though your brand has a track history, something that was real popular in the past. Mm-hmm. It's still popular, but they decide they want something that costs two or three times, and mm-hmm. then they tell me, cost is not an issue.
Mm. Professor Oliver, you want to respond first?
Well, I think there's three problems here. First of all, we as patients don't order almost anything that we get in terms of medical care. So it's our doctors doing it on our behalf. And as Ken points out, doctors are looking for who, if I refer one of my patients, who's going to get the best care. And the lack of competition means that the physician probably is not paying too much attention to the price. They're looking at quality. They may have a conflict of interest. They may refer to their own group of colleagues or themselves and do the procedure in a affiliated facility that they actually have an ownership interest in. Or there's lack of competition. You're the only group in town providing this service, and so you've got the insurance companies over a barrel. Those are all three problems that lead to higher prices. And, this is higher income. The thing about Elizabeth's article is U.S. healthcare, everybody in the system, including professors, I would say, get paid more in the United States than they do in other countries. And it's just built into the supposed cost structure.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in on the pay issue. Thank you so much, Ken, for your call. Someone writes, I worked in a hospital for 17 years. They kept cutting staff and yet could justify giving the CEO almost $1 million a year for wages and benefits. Hospitals are no longer caring institutions and should not be classified as nonprofit. Doctors are first businessmen. Then they are more concerned about that than they are about people. Pretty harsh statement. What do you say, Elizabeth?
I think that certainly Stephen Brill's article spoke to that issue fairly strongly about the business aspect of even the not-for-profit hospitals. My article and the endoscopy suite, the endoscopy practices, these ambulatory surgery centers, are actually mostly for-profit and as Dr. Oliver said, the one I looked at was owned by the gastroenterologists in the group who were referring to it. So, you know, they might say, oh, well, we know we do a good job, so that's why we're referring to our own ambulatory surgery center. But at another level, it's double dipping. You know, you get profit because you're doing the procedure, and you get profit because you own the facility, too. So these are big businesses in mm-hmm. the U.S. They're
Professor Oliver, should they be big businesses? Is there a better model?
Well, the big business that I think a lot of people would like to see is a single healthcare program for a community or a region or a state that is entirely not for profit, and that we take everybody's costs and everybody benefits into account, and then we begin to plan what services are appropriate and what are the guidelines, and we decide what are the appropriate incomes for people in that system,
mm-hmm.
and then we, you know, set up payments accordingly. And that is called a single-payer system, or you can have multiple, you know, insurance companies, but they all pay the same rate that is well-considered and out in public view. And that's something that we just completely lack. But Germany, the Netherlands, and France and other countries do a great job of.
John in La Crosse, hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're approaching the topic that I wanted to bring up, and I commend the audience and your people for going into this area. It's a concern of mine that up until hearing this program, whenever I hear a program that's decrying the high cost of health care, it has appeared to me that there are two areas that appear to be absolutely off limits for discussion, and that is what you just talked about, the high cost of the health care professionals and the outrageous high cost of facility. I don't know what it contributes to our procedures, but the specialists who earn several hundred thousand dollars a year and the new hospitals that are becoming to look like casinos or luxury hotels, that never appears to be discussed.
Elizabeth.
Could you address that?
Yes, we will. Thanks, John. Elizabeth.
Yes, certainly if you look at some of the European healthcare facilities where rates are much, much cheaper, there are no water fountains, there's no Starbucks, you know, they're much more basic places, but the quality of care doesn't change, I think, or it's arguably the same in studies, because what they're doing is delivering healthcare, not delivering kind of concierge services. So that really does, I think, contribute to our healthcare costs.
Joanne in Babcock. Hi.
Hi. I have two quick points, and then I'll hang up and listen to comments. 6 years ago, I twisted an ankle. I've been uninsured for many, many years. A lot of health issues, no job, that type of thing. 63-plus years old. Twisted an ankle, went to urgent care because I really thought it was broken. They took 6 x-rays. When my son broke his ankle in 1973, they took 1 x-ray. Why 6 x-rays versus 1? That's question number one. And the second point is, when I was married many, many years ago and had General Motors insurance through my husband, I had gold fillings put in my teeth.
Woo!
Most of those teeth are now gone, but because the insurance was good, that's what the dentist recommended because GM would pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, those teeth are gone, and I have no fillings, let alone no teeth. How can this kind of garbage go on? I appreciate the show, appreciate the guests. Have a great day.
Thanks, Joanne. Professor Oliver.
My guess is that Jillian was in a situation where trying to, quote, be sure about what was going on with her ankle led to the number of 6 x-rays, but that... I wouldn't be surprised if the folks providing those got paid 6 times the rate that if they had done just 1. And again, that's a problem in our system that's been widely recognized for a long time. And unless again, the provider is part of a system that's trying to pay attention to the total cost of care, and you don't get paid any more money if you do more procedures, then you're going to start judging the appropriateness of them and say enough is enough, or have the management that's earning these high salaries try to get a little more conscientious about working with its clinicians to say, let's do what's appropriate to each case, but no more.
Thank you, Joanne, for the call. I'm wondering what kind of response you have had to this article. I'm wondering what it's going to take to really spark this congressional investigation or whatever needs to happen to look at this issue. Because it's really amazing how little attention has been paid. So has the dialogue started, Elizabeth?
Well, I hope so, and I think so. We were overwhelmed by comments day the article appeared. We had more than 15,000 comments
Still
moderating.
Wow.
So I think it touched a nerve, which was our intention, and I hope it will be part of an ongoing dialogue as the series unfolds this year and will spark some more voter discussion, citizen discussion, and hopefully government discussion.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Saeed in Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Elizabeth's article is very interesting, and she is rather unusual as a patient that she actually cares about what the cost of her care is. Frankly, most people don't, because if we bought the reason why costs of health care have escalated in the way that they have is has many, many, many factors. It's multifactorial, and we don't have time to discuss all of it. But probably the most significant is that medical services are bought and sold, where I buy, you sell, and somebody else pays. At Hello, most people have exhausted their deductible, and they no longer care. So the market is not price sensitive. There is no real free market competition in our current system at all. In my environment in Green Bay, Wisconsin, for example, there are three programs that do cardiac surgery. One of them has been doing it the longest, has the lowest cost and the better outcomes, but only claims about a third of the market because the market is not priced or quality sensitive. And so as opposed to what the professor is suggesting, it was central planning of some individual or entity that knows it all, can set the prices, set the level of services and all of that, which has historically never worked. Isn't it better that we remove barriers to free market competition and have inquiries of the type that Elizabeth is doing, patients motivated by their search for value?
All right, Professor Oliver.
Well, the main problem with that is that patients don't get to make those decisions. Those are ordered through the medical care system, and so it is up to doctors and healthcare managers and insurance companies, including Medicare and Medicaid, to do the research and figure out what are the appropriate payments to be made and put some pressure. And it may be bad publicity on the part of people who are really gouging the system in this respect. So there's a lot of valuable mechanisms, but we need a lot more information in everybody's hands. But to dump this on us as patients going into a system in complicated situations with great uncertainty and no expertise and unfamiliarity with how things work is really, I think, inappropriate and unfair. And the political rhetoric that suggests that consumers are responsible for these high costs is really outrageous, in my view.
Elizabeth, pick whatever country you want. You've lived there. But let's look at not a national system. Let's look at a private system somewhere else in the world whose costs are significantly lower. How do they negotiate prices?
Well, part of it is just volume. If you're negotiating as a country for the your population, you can pick a price. In some countries, what they do is they get all of the insurers and all of the hospitals together in the same room and pick a price. You know, it has to do come down with numbers and transparency. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of negotiating power, you can get a price that's lower. So if you're negotiating for your whole population, it's much more effective than if you're negotiating for the 15 people in your insurance plan.
John in Richland Center. Saeed, thanks for your call. Hi, John.
Hello. I used to work for world headquarters of General Electric Medical in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and I was paid to build CAT scanners and then MRI scanners. Mm-hmm. Well, I just know for the numbers that it's not fair because GE sells them for $1,500,000. That means a hospital has to sell 1,000 scans at $1,500 each. They're selling more scans to pay for the CAT scanners. But the radiation is like 5,000 times than you'd have near the Japanese nuclear power plants eating some vegetables for one slice. It's just not fair.
I'm not sure I'm getting all of this. Do you get this, Professor Oliver?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure of John's point, but I think one of the things is that, again, the technology companies that supply this high-tech medicine that we are so enamored of in this country, they do make a very good profit on what they're doing, but then that cost has been easily passed on through the system. But it puts pressure on the healthcare system that acquire this expensive technology to really pump up the volume of procedures, which again leads to questionable judgments about, is it always appropriate to do these procedures? Are they necessary? And as the caller's point is, sometimes you're actually taking risks with radiation or other unintended consequences of undergoing treatments or diagnostics.
Mm, thank you for clarifying that. Thanks, John, for your call. Slattery in Mirabel. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to make 3 points. The first is personal. When I was 50 years old, I was working in Japan as a foreign resident. I had a colonoscopy done there, and I got a card in the mail from the National Health Insurance saying, you know, that I was permitted to do that. It cost me $40 to $50. Mm. National Health Insurance picked up the rest. So my second point is, why was it so cheap? It is cheap because of just your previous caller. The government determines what is the level under National Health Insurance that may be billed to people, and they also determine what is the level of prices that are acceptable for purchasing this high-tech equipment. And the company I was working for happens to be one of the top four medical equipment makers in the world, and they're producing MRIs and CT scanners, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They're selling them in Japan for probably half of what they're sold here.
Oh.
They are not staying in Japan because they aren't making money. They are making money. So the point that I'm trying to make is, we're just simply extracting, at least our medical companies and our hospitals, et cetera, are extracting too high a profit, which is driving up medical costs.
Okay, let's get a response, Slattery, because we have so many calls coming in. Elizabeth.
Yeah, I think, you know, Japan is an interesting model for scan prices because Japan sets what's the allowable charge for scans, and it's much, much lower than it is in the U.S. And yet, as our caller said, the scanners are still open. I think Japan has one of the highest rates of CT scanning in the world. People are making money. So I do think we're paying prices that are... We're not getting what we pay for. We're paying too much.
Thanks for the call. More phone calls in a moment. The cost of health care is what we're talking about this hour of the show. Elizabeth Rosenthal wrote the front page piece Sunday's New York Times. We're putting it on our Facebook page in case you missed that important article, which she said has received 15,000 responses, huge number of responses, paying till it hurts. It's part of a series, so you'll see more attention on this issue. Professor Tom Oliver is also with us, professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences, director of the UW Master of Public Health Program. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. You can always use our email if you want to do that, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to calls, Paul in West Bend. Hi.
Hi, good morning. This is the only service that we buy that we do not procure competitive bids. When hospitals put on an addition or some modifications inside the hospital, they prepare a set of plans and specifications, and they solicit from 4 to 8 bids. And in those bid packages, everything is listed, including the insurance coverage, so that you're getting equal. The numbers come in, they're all apples. They're not apples and oranges. There is competition introduced into the delivery system. All the insurance companies do is pass on the added cost with your jacked-up annual premium. So a good example is I had my wife in to check 3 small moles in her face and neck. The doctor looked at it and said, no, these are not cancerous, but we can remove them. Should we set up an appointment for that? And I said, well, why can't you just take out the nitrogen vial now and hit them now? He looked at me officially and then proceeded to do that. I got a bill for $476.
Woo.
I mean, you think I was hiring a senior partner at a large competing law firm. Just pointing out that if there's no competition, you're going to get screwed over.
Professor Oliver.
Yeah, we need lots of competition, but it has to be competition within a framework. And the way that most of our international standards are set in other countries are that there's a negotiated price or a fixed price through the government or through negotiation with, and once that price is set, then the competition is around, can you provide that service and make a profit at it? And so those that can are obviously going to do better. And if that then fits into a package of insurance that is less costly and that is passed on to the consumer, then we see economic incentives driving us towards efficiency. And they have figured out how to use competition towards efficiency and better quality. We have primarily competition because it's open-ended that adds cost to our system.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, I'm interested in how often this series, Pay Till It Hurts, is going to run in the Times.
Well, it's a very interesting series. We're hoping to do at least one a month, okay. Probably more than that. But we're asking, as a part of the reason we got so much response is we're asking for reader input. And we want to hear what readers are experiencing out there, what procedures they've seen really high charges for. And their responses will actually help guide further articles. So
great.
There could be a lot more.
I still can't get over that. 15,000 responses.
Yeah, I have my weekend reading cut out for me.
I guess you do. And then some. Paul, thanks for the call. Amanda in Green Bay. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I'm a physician assistant, so speaking from a healthcare provider.
I'm sorry, I missed that. What are you, Amanda?
I'm a physician assistant, a PA.
Okay.
So speaking from a healthcare provider perspective, I think.
Okay.
I'm a little discouraged by some of the comments regarding us being business people. I think most of us still go into the profession feeling that we want to help people. And in fact, I often spend a lot of time in the office trying to figure out ways to reduce costs for patients and to help them out and often try to think in their best interest when ordering a test or procedure. And trying to figure out what's necessary. The second comment is, it seems like a lot of people utilize the healthcare system in higher cost surfaces, such as an ER visit for a cold that could wait for the next day in their primary care provider's office, and then not pay the bills. I've both worked in primary care and the ER, and it's kind of ridiculous the things you see the ER visits for that you know will never get paid, and that gets deflected onto other people mm-hmm. to pay those costs.
Professor Oliver?
This is a wonderful opportunity to point out how much pressure and burden we're putting on our primary care providers, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, family doctors, pediatricians, and so forth. They are, I believe, really committed to trying to figure out what their patients, uninsured or insured, can afford and what is appropriate care, but they're understaffed themselves, they're underpaid, they're overworked, and it's enormous pressure. And honestly, what happens more often than not, in my experience and friends that I know, is that we're sent to the ER, or our friends or spouses are sent there by family doctors who simply can't fit you into their schedule. And so there's a lot of dumping out of need that ends up going into this very high-cost technology, intensive kind of high-cost care. So, Amanda, you're not alone, and we have tons of students who are really have great, honorable intentions, and I know are committed out there, but they're also put in a system where the pressure is to become specialists and make three or four times as much money on a more regular schedule and not take a lot of time around each patient.
Right. Do you think we've been too harsh on doctors and providers, Elizabeth?
Well, I should mention that in my deep, dark background, I actually trained as a physician as
internist. Oh.
Yeah. So I'm very, and my father was a physician also. So I'm very sympathetic to the frontline providers, the general practitioners, the nurse practitioners, the physician's assistants. They are put in a really difficult and untenable position. And a lot of them are the people who are saying the Medicare payments are low because our system focuses on procedures. So if you do procedures, you make a lot more money. If you actually see patients and spend time with them, your reimbursements are much lower. So it is a system problem. It's not that, there are, that these doctors aren't trying to do their best for their patients.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, thank you so much for your call. Ashley in Madison. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. This kind of builds off of what the last caller is talking about in that there are problems with the system for the providers themselves. One thing, talking with some of the doctors that I work with, they're in a situation where if they don't do a lot of what are seen by clients as extra procedures, they might be setting themselves up for malpractice lawsuits. And this country, as we know, is so sue happy. So I feel a lot of doctors feel like those extra things that they're doing are they're doing to protect them, their patients, and to protect their own practice.
Professor Oliver.
Yes, Kathleen, this is a huge problem that should have been solved along with expansion of insurance and the cost containment efforts that are now underway in healthcare reform. We should have solved this malpractice insurance problem because these are high costs dumped on physicians and other healthcare providers. They are subject to a lot of liability and uncertainty. And again, we need a more systems approach that compensates people who are injured or hurt through the system without having massive rewards for some and nothing for most.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's the same system that has people like Amanda. They've got some free medications that have been given to them by the companies to give out to people who can't afford the drugs that they need. But is that really a systems approach, or should we have an appropriate price and everybody in the system, and then we figure out what's right so that you're not basically giving out charity to a handful
right.
of people and everybody else is paying through the nose?
Yeah, it's not a good system. Final one to you, Elizabeth, WJ emails, after 30-plus years as a physician, I think the current system is broken and corrupt. My personal solution to this immoral system, some flavor of a single-payer system, and with 14 years of education, training, and over 30 years of quality practice, I don't feel overpaid. A plumber will be paid more per hour than Medicare pays me.
Well, yes, I think this is back to I don't know what kind of physician the gentleman is, but certainly people complain that Medicare pays too little to primary care providers. And Medicare is not really where the crux of the problem is that I was talking about. It's in the private payer segment. But I think, you know, I was somewhat heartened that some of the responses were from physicians who said, yes, the system is broken, but yes, you're right. There's, you know, we use our resources badly. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of frustration. I mean, that's what's surprising to me. People are frustrated on all sides of this equation, which to me says the system has to change in some way.
Yeah. Well, you're doing your part. And then some. Thank you, Elizabeth, very much for writing the article and being with us. Professor Oliver, thank you so much. We'll talk again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Elizabeth Rosenthal, her piece is in the New York Times last Sunday. We will post it on her Facebook page. Tom Oliver, professor at UW-Madison, where he directs the public health program. We'll be with you again Monday, All Things Political at 9, and the upcoming season of the American Players Theater at 10 o'clock on Monday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this show. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.